We don't want to be moralists, you know, with what we do. I mean, maybe a little bit, but but we are here to see if over time we can, you know, work together with other practitioners and other brands in ways that are more expansive.
That's Simone Farsin, and this is the On Design podcast. Hi everyone, and welcome to the new episode of the On Design podcast. I'm your host, Justina Green. I'm an illustrator, and I've also spent the past 10 years in the design industry in various roles. On this podcast, as you might already know, every week we speak to the most exciting people in design right now. We learn what inspires them, how they work, and how they see the world. And if you're new to the pod, well, welcome. And I'm super happy to have you join our community. And in today's episode, I speak to Simone Farsin of Forma Fantasma. Many of you might already know, of course, of Forma Fantasma. But for you, all, those of you who might not, or just a refresher for everyone, they are a research-based design studio that investigates the ecological, historical, political, and social forces that are shaping the discipline of design today. And in our conversation, we discuss the studio's trajectory across more than a decade now since its inception. And we dive into the three aspects of the practice: their research work, a commercial project, as well as work in the field of education, as they're recently appointed heads of the geodesign department at Design Academy Eindhoven. It's a brilliant, very interesting, in-depth conversation. Here it is for you to enjoy. Has it been 12 years now of Forma Fantasma?
Well, we always say that it's actually 10 years because we started in actually, so it would be 11 years in a way, because we started in 2009 officially. I mean, we registered our company, but it was in October 2009. So in a way, we feel that we started in 2010.
And so before that, kind of what was happening prior to you establishing, you know, the company Forma Fantasma, how did you two come together and what bonded you from the design perspective?
Of course. Well, me and Andrea, we actually met in Florence, so not in Eindhoven, where we studied the master, but during our bachelor studies at an institution called ISIA, which was one of the first schools that was conceived regarding industrial design in Italy after the economic boom. And we met there. And I think our meeting was extremely important because I'm a bit older than Andrea, and I was losing interest in the design discipline, at least the sort of the industrial design side. And I think meeting him made me look back at my experience at university from a different perspective. And, you know, we started our relationship, a private one, I mean, we started to engage with, you know, living together, living in the world. And we realized after a while that all our conversations were about design at the end of the day, but a more expansive idea of design. And we decided to apply together with one joint portfolio at Design Academy in Eindhoven. And that's where we did our master studies, which was an extremely important step in our education. And then once we graduated with a joint project, then we also opened our studio immediately.
And tell me, you mentioned you started to lose interest in industrial design.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I was studying in Italy, in around 2000, let's say, a bit later, but I started around then. And, you know, I think design in Italy in that period wasn't the most interesting aspect of Italian design. You know, we decided to study both. We decided to study in Florence because we felt the education there could have been more radical than, for instance, at Politecnico in Milan. And, you know, you have to think that the radical architecture and design movement established first in Florence and then came to be known in Milan. But the theoretical side of it was really conceived in Florence. So that's where we were coming from. But despite we had some great experiences with teachers there and you know, we totally did not regret having studied there, the atmosphere was different, and design was seen much more as a tool, I would say, for industry, and it was a bit maybe less critical. And so, yes, I was not engaging with it that much. This maybe because I started personally, and therefore Andrea has been a bit different, but I started to be interested in design quite early on when I was, you know, 14, when I started to study in an art school. I was starting to be passionate about design. I had, you know, posters of exhibition of Enzo Mari and Ettore Sottsass in my room, instead of having, you know, pop stars, posters and so on. So once I got there, I had a feeling that the aspects that I was interested in design were much less technical, much less closer to engineering. And I felt there was a dryness in my studies that didn't allow me to explore the things I was interested in design. And that's why we decided to go to Design Academy in Eindhoven, that had, I think, a much more open perspective on the discipline. And the questions we received there were much more about who we wanted to be as designers, why a certain body of work would make sense in a certain moment in time. There were questions not really about the production processes, for instance, and how it fit, you know, marketing or whatever, but much more about the meaning of acting in the world, which is what we were interested in, actually, as designers. And so we grew to become who we are as designers in Eindhoven, despite the education in Italy was extremely formative and extremely important.
Because I guess if you didn't have the education in Italy, you wouldn't come to the point when you realized, you know, you're looking at something that's more radical, more critical.
Yes, but also not only. I mean, I have to say that coming from a country that has such an expansive history of design, you know, inevitably, I think we came to Eindhoven with a much more awareness also of how the discipline evolved over time. So we had much more, I would say, a historical perspective to it, and a tiny bit more of an academic preparation mm-hmm. compared to Eindhoven, that was an academy. You know, the other one was a university. So also the kind of approach was different. And in Italy, we had the chance to study more on an academic level, also on semiotic studies and sociology and so on.
And when you joined Eindhoven, how did you find the two of you started to work together? Would you have the same kind of viewpoint, or are you different in certain aspects that then brings Forma Fantasma together?
Yeah, well, you know, when we started and we applied as a duo, we didn't realize we were doing something sort of, I wouldn't say extravagant, but at least unusual, because maybe we were coming from the experience in Italy. And I want to stress again that the school was, if not founded, but engaged with the radical designers of the 70s. They were used to working groups and so on. So for us, it wasn't that weird, let's say. And for us, you know, design is something that we do together. So there is not something that is about one or the other. I think it is really about a dialogue. So in fact, we always say that our favorite tool for design is words, in terms of conversation between the two of us. So it was not about defining who does what. That came, I would say, much later when we established our own design studio. Inevitably, as a designer, you have to do things that not necessarily has to do with design, like, for instance, speaking in this moment, or writing emails and organizing events, or even teaching and so on. So when we start to grow in our position of it as a design studio, then we started also realizing that we have different skills, and there is much more organized, much more scheduled, much more of a decision maker, that at one point he says, let's cut with the bullshit, you know, the work ends up here, and I'm all the time instead opening up possibilities and being a bit more messy and so on. So we have our own position, but you know, our worldview is extremely similar. So we never question where we want to get with our work. We can question how to get there, you know? And in fact, working together, it is having a common vision, but being constantly devil's advocate which is also what makes, I think, for us, our work interesting, because whenever we receive a critique that we find it constructive, we always saw that already. Maybe we didn't sort it out, but because we are in two, so it is always this constant dialogue and double checking about the ideas we are developing.
And through that dialogue, what kind of work do you want to create as a studio, and how has that evolved over the past 10 years?
The work really evolved over the years, and I think that there has been a moment during our studies that we really, I think, formalized who we are in a way, which was in fact our graduation work. And from that moment on, I think we were extremely interested in the ability of objects and design to sit in a very liminal zone between economy, production, culture, environmental questions. And this ambiguity of design, or it's not probably an ambiguity, but this reality of design is what we have been interested. So when we started working in the first years, we were really much studio material-based. In a way, we still are. Material-based in the sense that we were interested in exploring materials, also with a hands-on approach. But a level of intuition was extremely important in the first years, where we developed also more, if not independent, because they were still commissioned work, but at least they were, they had a strong degree of freedom, where we started to explore some ideas we were interested in, many of which were still connected to ecology or the significance of objects as cultural conduits, the tension between, for instance, craft and nationalism or even colonialism. And I think most recently, we started to understand that our practice is divided essentially in a few different parts. One is much more research-based, and it's not necessarily linked to the production of objects. One that is a bit more commercial, and it responds to necessities of clients, and that is important for us to sustain our practice and also the more research-based work we do. And the third part that has to do with education. And of course, there are subsections, I would say, in there. But one is providing services, the other one is much more research-based, and one is supposed to feed the other. And possibly over the years, in the next 10 years of studio, we hope to find also possibilities of joining these different components. Because, you know, not always when you have a client, you can actually explore ideas on a radical level. You know, we've seen that before in many practices. You know, I don't want to compare our practice to the one of Rem Koolhaas, of course, because we could never dare to say that. But if you think about a research-based design studio, of course, you know, that's a very good reference. And we saw him like building masterpieces architecture that not necessarily were as challenging or as interesting as his theoretical work or their theoretical works. So we understood that conceiving our practice divided in these parts can allow also freedom. And in a way to make maybe a part of our practice more commercial and a part of our practice more radical, in the hope, of course, that one can feed the other.
Mm-hmm. And how do you manage or kind of sustain that freedom? Can you sustain that within the research practice, or how do you bring that to your commercial projects as well?
Yeah, that's a very good question. Well, it is a constant struggle. So, but it is also an extremely positive struggle. I think that often design is not read in context, and the work of designers is not read in context. And for context, I mean that sometimes we see that some people do not see the difference between designers that work, for instance, on an academic level, doing academic research. For instance, we don't do academic research. You know, that's a different thing. Still, it is a form of research, but we we like to act in this in the world, I would say, not that some other works on academic level is not doing that, but you know, our practice again can confront with clients that need an interior, or clients that produces phones and they want materials and finishing, and of course not necessarily that is linked to our more research-based practice. And sometimes we can try to join the two, but sometimes we cannot join the two. But nevertheless, we learn plenty of things of how, for instance, a huge company dealing with electronics divide their design process between different cities and different teams. And we can observe up close the system that we are interested in critiquing and rethinking. So there is not always a relationship that is of research and translation and transformation of the subject, but it is also for us sometimes producing more commercial work is also a way of acting within the world that we are also interested in rethinking. Nevertheless, most recently, for instance, with Cambio, the exhibition we did at Serpentine about the governance of the timber industry, we decided to work with the subject of wood because we understood, even if the subject really is the governance of the timber industry in that exhibition, but timber, compared, for instance, to electronic waste or electronic objects, is an industry that intersect architecture, product design, half-finished materials, and furniture, and so on. So it allow us to communicate, I would say, with a more to a public or to clients that inherently are interested in what we do, like, for instance, the furniture industry. And in this moment, we are, for instance, trying with a client to look at what they do, considering their biome of reference, which is the forest, and thinking which way we can maybe radicalize a bit more what they already do. So it is already a fantastic reality we are working with. They are already doing, you know, plenty of things that are fully responsible in terms of engagement with the ecosystem, but we can make them more deep. We can radicalize that. And this is what we are interested in doing. So using our research practice to show that we as designers could work as an external R&D, for instance, for a company. Mm-hmm. We find that obvious with the work we do, but plenty of people do not realize that. And so, but you know, we have plenty of time to do that. Not plenty of time, but I mean, the next 10 years of studio should be focused on this. And education is also a way for us to expanding on this and realizing that, you know, your thinking sometimes, our own thinking sometimes is more radical than what we do. And a way of exploring that is not through our own work, but maybe through the works of others via, you know, the involvement with education. We as designers often think in terms of the lifespan of an object or the lifetime of a designer. But if we think about ecology, we need to think about of a much larger time scale, even if we are in a hurry to face ecological issues. And we need to think about more as a community of people should also be transgenerational. So for us, education is a way of expanding our work beyond ourselves.
So tell me more about geodesign. How did it come together? What is the program? Kind of where you're at with it now, and where do you want to take it? Or like, what have you seen already being created?
Damn it, so many questions. No, I'm kidding. Because of course, when you start something, you well, we often know, you know where you start, and you know, but you don't really know where. Well, you also know where you want to go, but the path in between is, you know, extremely complex and full of hopefully interesting detours. But first of all, I want to say that the idea of geodesign was introduced in Eindhoven, a design academy in Eindhoven, by Joseph Grima, who is a creative director of Design Academy in Eindhoven. And it was also explored, for instance, by Martina Muzzi as a curator with a geodesign platform. So geodesign is not, you know, our own thing. It is, again, not the outcome of one person, but a collaborative project, if it's not a collaborative project, is not something that we own. You know, it belongs to the world, and it was introduced by Joseph, who was generous enough to offer us to become heads of this department in Eindhoven. And so we had the freedom to structure it in whatever way we wanted, and also to, in a way, to interpret the term geodesign in our own way, even if, you know, with Joseph, we share, I think, a similar way of thinking. He recently initiated a very interesting project about non-extractive architecture. So there is definitely, you know, a common ground, and also with Martina Munzi. But essentially, it is about looking, using design to look not only into ways of providing services and products to the users and using design to fulfill those needs, but also to critically observe the infrastructure upon which design perform that is often given for granted. But we believe that via the critical observation analysis of that infrastructure, designers can also provide a more complex thinking that maybe is about not only providing services, but also rethinking the system that provides them. To give an example, you know, even our own work with the exhibition on the Serpentine, looking at infrastructure of the extractions of timber from forest, it is about that. It is about understanding, you know, the not only the chain of custody, but also the politics, the shapes, the many industries that we as designers are inevitably working with. And of course, it is obvious to say that the ecological concern is at the core of this department. And maybe, you know, if we think about the term geodesign, the way we want to interpret it is that for a very long time, and I'm borrowing some ideas from Bruno Latour in his Down to Earth book, for a very long time we conceived design, not only design but also politics, in a very stable environment, the planet. But because of the climate crisis, the Earth that we give it for granted is not stable anymore. And in this sense, it is simply not possible to conceive anymore design without thinking at a planetary scale we operate within, but also at the fact that the ground upon which we step is not as stable anymore. And inevitably, we have to think about this relationship. Many people think that, you know, obviously everybody is dealing with ecological design and so on, or with sustainability. But what we're trying with geodesign is to make it a bit more radical. It's not about thinking about sustainability in terms of, you know, using biodegradable material instead of the plastic, for instance, but it's thinking on a much more complex level and at different scales. At the moment, for instance, the students are working with an architect and a conservationist on a project that is about looking critically at the idea of rewilding on a specific location here in the Netherlands. So the students their clients, for instance, in this moment are animals. They're not humans. And this is something that, for instance, we are interested in exploring as designers. And we thought this was an interesting, for instance, subject to explore within geodesign.
That's very interesting. And here we're looking at kind of expanding on that thought where, for example, a brand might come to you and say that they like to commission you to create a sustainable product and kind of put it into production straight away. While you might say, well, how about we take 2-3 years to figure out, I don't know, your supply chain and see what's happening there, what we can fix there.
Indeed, exactly. I mean, when a client comes to us and he says like, oh, we want to do a sustainable product, what we say is like, let's design a good old fashioned product, you know, that it's long lasting, that it's, you know, with decent materials that we, because when we have requests like that, it means that, you know, there's no idea at all what it really means to create, you know, a real ecological thinking within a company. That's total bullshit. You know, it's so naive and also actually so utterly ignorant that it's not even worth it to really trying, I would say. But with some companies, we are starting to build a relationship, you know, and that's when you do that, you can then suddenly have much more an in-depth conversation. It is also about getting to know each other, you know. So some clients come to us because they see our work published, they see how it looks, and they find it interesting, but they don't necessarily know what we are talking about with our own work. So it is also about getting to know each other. And I also have to say, it's not that the world is full of stupid people or stupid companies, just also the, you know, brands and companies, they're also very busy in sustaining their businesses and paying, you know, salaries to a struggling community of workers and so on. So, you know, we completely understand the struggles, and we are not here to, we don't want to be moralists, you know, with what we do. I mean, maybe a little bit, but we are here to see if over time we can, you know, work together with other practitioners and other brands in ways that are more expansive.
And do you think this is something that will grow or will be easier to achieve in the years to come? Can you see changes already happening within brands, or do you think there's a long way ahead?
There's definitely a long way ahead, but I think, for instance, we really care about this because if we do it and if more people are vocal about this and if their work is presented in this way, there will be more people that will see these opportunities and companies will see these opportunities. And so, you know, you open up a path. I mean, for instance, I can say that in our case, when Hella Jungerius started working for Vitra, but working on materials and finishing and colors, it was a different way of approaching design, not based on designing objects, but looking more holistically at the materiality of a company. And we believe that's interesting. You can call that art direction, but it's slightly different than art direction here.
So that already taps into research and just different approach to design,
yeah.
Right? Yeah, yeah.
Absolutely.
And moving from... Or we're actually not going anywhere from being sustainably minded, but we're leaving the earth to go digital. And I know there's been quite a lot of conversation and buzz around your new website. And I wanted to talk to you about it, about, I guess what I found interesting is that, you know, for many brands, relaunching a website is making something more beautiful, faster to work with a better customer journey, etc. Well, it's looks like your website became a project in itself.
Unexpectedly. I mean, we were not, so maybe I can tell a bit how it came about and, mm-hmm. and so that we can also talk about its content. But basically, we had a horrible website. Horrible. We had it for years, but it wasn't really what we wanted after a while, but it was there. And of course, as you know, website works, it becomes outdated and you forget about them and so on. And at one point, you know, we thought, okay, no, let's rethink about a website. And we knew in any case that we wanted to do the website much more text-based, because there are other outlets, you know, such as Instagram. You know, there's plenty of outlets where the visual content can be there. And we wanted the website to be less iconographic, I would say, and to look more into the content of what we do. And then we were talking here in the studio, and at one point in the process of thinking about this, somebody here in the studio, his name was Gregorio, he's not working with us anymore. At one point he said, like, well, there's nothing more suiting your work if we start to look in the infrastructure of the internet. And we thought, like, yes, that this is a brilliant idea. And we started looking into that and how the internet is, of course, we were aware of that much earlier than now when we did the website, also through the project we did previously, Aura Streams, about electronic waste, how much even ourselves, but also people are unaware that the internet and online behavior is extremely polluting, and that the internet is not just virtual, but it is made of an infrastructure that consumes energy, you know, to, for instance, cool the machines that store our data, that architectures are built, that, you know, cables are running around the world to provide this infrastructure. So we started looking into what design can do on that level, and in which way the design of an interface can help more, suitable online behavior. And we bumped into this online magazine called Low Tech Magazine, which became our main references because also they have been extremely generous and offering a lot of suggestions on how to build a more sustainable website. But we also looked at our own online behavior. We looked a bit at, we studied a bit online behaviors in general to design a website that is possibly the lightest as possible and the least consuming as possible in terms of CO2 emissions. And that's how it came to exist. And so the design and its aesthetic, it's dictated by that. And it is interesting because, in fact, it looks a very sort of early days internet kind of aesthetic, which has been extremely explored on an aesthetic level by many designers in the last years. But weirdly enough, nobody looked into that as an opportunity for making a website much more efficient in terms of an energy efficiency. Not no one, but not so many people looked into that, or it is not yet mainstream, I would say. And it's bizarre because many of these websites they use this very early days internet aesthetic. They are absolutely not energy efficient at all. So instead, we work with a studio in Italy called Studio Blanco. And they have been designing it, and we gave them sort of a more articulated brief. It was funny because at the beginning we had this loose conversation, and at one point they were coming back saying, like, so you need like a page with works and a page with this and a page with that. And we were horrified. We were like, wait a minute, you know, like, no, this is not like how we work. This sounds like, I don't know, it just sounds not us at all. So we took some time, and then we sent them back a PDF with a much extensive briefs and saying like, okay, look, we need to use this type of typefaces. We need to look into this. And then they completely engaged in it, and they came up with brilliant solutions and making the website, you know, even more sophisticated than we could think, of course, because we're not graphic designers. And yes, this is how it came to exist.
And you've had a really positive response to it, haven't you?
Yeah, and plenty of negative one also.
Really?
We had, yeah.
Tell me about the negative.
Yeah, like it was amazing. Like I think it was posted on a famous online blog and of design, and we had people saying that it was the biggest bullshit in the world. It was greenwashing. As if we are a company to green. I mean, we don't have anything to wash. That's the problem. We wish we would have plenty of, you know, of things to wash away. There's nothing to wash in our studio, I would say. It was completely bollocks, but it is not. It is not really. I think it's just a lot of people are not aware of what they're talking about. We had people also misinterpreting completely, and it says like, but there's nothing new about this. It's post-internet aesthetic. So there is a shallowness of how people look at design in general, I think. There's plenty of even designers that are completely shallow. They don't even know what they are talking about. And so they don't even have the sophistication to understand what a work was about. Even reading was too difficult, I guess, for them. But we don't care about negative responses, really. It's just that what show us is that people are unaware of simply that the internet is a thing. It's not like a cloud. You know what I mean? Maybe it is also a problem of linguistic. When you call something a cloud, you image constructed of dust and particles. Instead, here we're talking about buildings, we're talking about cables, we're talking about, we need to change the semantics of this also in the way we talk about things to make people aware. But at the end of the day, this just felt natural for us. And we didn't think also that people would conceive it would. We know we didn't consider it as a project, you know, and we talk also with some journalists, and at one point they said, you should really have it in your website as one of the works, which is true. But, you know, it was sort of a meta work for us, you know, it was we didn't really think about that.
And this brings me to kind of a thought that I wanted to share with you and explore a bit more, because you said that first thing on the website when you want to, we're redesigning, is to make it more text-based. And then we're now talking about people who maybe look, watch, don't read. So tell me, is there a problem or do you have a problem kind of when you get commissioned for work or when people approach you that it's very much visually based rather than based on the research?
Not necessarily, because our work is also extremely visual. And actually, I don't have a problem with that at all, because the reason why Mina there we came to design is because the things that touched us, they weren't, well, there were also books, honestly, and literature and so on, but they were also visual. You know what I mean? When we started to engage with ideas, it's also because they touched us on a visual level. I could give plenty of examples. So no, I don't have any problem with that, because I think everybody has different talents. Everybody has different ways of understanding things. And, you know, personally, even my own way of reading the world is visual. And plenty of original ideas we got was not by reading books, but it was by observing materials and things that exist in the world as objects. No, we don't have a problem with that. We do have a problem when it is very easy to approach designers without putting the effort in understanding what their work is about.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't know, it's sort of bizarre. You know, you should start to get to know each other, of course, also by knowing each other. But if you ask somebody to join a company, it's also because you should know what their work is about. And we find that a bit weird.
But so have you had those conversations where you were approached to do something and then realized that people don't really know?
Yes, but I don't mind also. I mean, or I don't mind. I mind deeply.
But you accept that it happens.
We accept that it happens, and we accept also that it is also up to us to understand, to explain what we do. And also sometimes we just simply also realize, okay, this is we have plenty of people that contact us because they know what we do, and then you're engaged in a conversation on a certain level, and then you have people that know our work less, and you engage on a different level.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and then you know, we are also, again, a studio that is also providing services. And of course, we also realize that it's important to work, to develop work, because you learn from it. You also learn to understand who the person in front of you or the company is, and they learn who you are. And through that process, we can grow, maybe, or maybe not. But in a way, working together is the best way of getting to know each other.
Mm-hmm.
You cannot just pose into any difficult questions at the beginning. I mean, you can, but it's much easier and much better and more effective when people came to you because they understand your work. Then you can challenge them a lot. But if you don't know each other, it's better to start working, and then on the way you see if there is a path in front or not.
And talking about because you said about, you know, how you don't, that how you express, perceive the world very visually. You learn not necessarily just from the books, but from what's around you. What have you learned in the past year or so? How has that affected your thinking or desire to do different projects, new projects?
Yeah. That's a very good question. Well, the first answer is, I don't know yet. The process of digestion is very long, and everybody thinks that inspiration is about being exposed to things. We think it is about digestion, and it's about actually not being exposed to things, since you are so much exposed to things all the time. I mean, also because of digital medias and tools. So we don't know yet. We know that... we know that it is more difficult to accept shallow works, but we also notice the less shallow works comes in. So I think everybody feels that, you know, there is or at least I hope it will be like this, that we shouldn't go back to before. Of course, implicitly here we're talking about the pandemic. Of course, I also want to go back to dance and to sweat together with other people and to, you know, be bodily and to, you know, be a human together with other humans and being social and drinking and wasted and, you know, doing all these frivolous things that as humans we need. On the other side, I think we don't want anymore, you know, the amount of silliness that we've seen before. At least this is a wish, I would say. And again, I don't want to be moralist. You know, I can't wait, as I said, to go to a party or be silly and, you know, and be frivolous. But at the same time, we cannot upset stupidity anymore. At least I hope the pandemic can take us to this different level of engagement, for instance, with a problem connected to ecology. I don't know how many people interpret the pandemic as a result of the ecological crisis, but at least we do. And it, you know, it's finally, it is physically present. You know, we are experiencing what a climate crisis is. It is about being in lockdown. It is about being secluded. It is about injustice. So I hope we can move forward from this.
Absolutely. And very final question to start kind of wrapping up our conversation. So moving forward, what is your direction for you guys? What are you doing maybe this year, but what are you thinking longer term?
Well, first, there is a very important change. So we are moving to Milan. So we are relocating to Italy. We will keep a studio in Holland, a small studio here. But essentially, we will relocate to Italy. So that for us is a very important change. For us, it's radical. It took ages to decide. And the pandemic accelerated this process. And it's a personal change, of course, but it's also a very important one. And then we are, at the moment, working. I'm talking about the very basic things we're doing in the studio. We are working on a lot of the exhibition design, which is becoming constant in the studio since basically 2 years. Mm-hmm. And we are continuing Cambio with, in the way that I said before, like in collaboration with a company, but also with a touring of the exhibition. It is in 2 weeks opening in Tuscany, and then it will be in Switzerland. We are reprinting the third edition of the catalog, expanded. So we are expanding the exhibition once it's traveled, and we are expanding the catalog, which is a lot of work, obviously. We are a bit regretting it, but okay. We had a lot of support also from Serpentine in this sense. And then we are working on industrial design, several different projects. And we are starting to think to initiate a new research project. And of course, we are extremely busy with geodesign. So in a way, we are expanding and continuing what we already did, and looking for new outlets and ways of working.
Mm-hmm. And have you started working on that new research project now you mentioned?
No, not yet, not fully. But I think there are some subjects that we have in mind.
Are you still digesting?
No, I think it's more that when we do a research project, they take a lot of time and a lot of energy. And so we alternate that to more also commercial work to balance it out. But I don't want to say anything because maybe we will change, we will do other things. It also depends also what comes in the studio. But let's say that we are exploring some ideas with the students of geodesign that they are exploring, honestly. But of course, for instance, we installed some ideas in there, for instance, in terms of who is teaching there and how and the subjects and so on that we are also interested in exploring. So it goes hand in hand. But for now, we are continuing with Cambio because there's plenty that we have to do there. We would be interested in continuing what we did with Aura Streams regarding electronic waste. So we want to do not let this work sort of die there. Mm-hmm. Actually, Cambio should not at all. So, but our main point is that we want to make this not develop necessarily as sort of museums works or works that are more for the public that engaging on a cultural level with exhibitions and so on, but to drag them back into applications. So that's our interest, I would say. But definitely what we are interested in this moment is we are thinking a lot about other than humans, so animals and other creatures on the planet, and if and how design can do something in that realm. We would love if our next client is not anymore a human. It would be brilliant if we would stop designing for humans for a while. And maybe that has also to do with the fact that we have a pet now, since a year, a dog. And yeah, it's wonderful to live with other creatures, and it's wonderful to have them around. And so why not thinking about them instead of thinking about humans?
Perfect. So if we have any humans with animals listening to the podcast, we can start a discussion. It sounds very interesting, and I really look forward to seeing what will come from kind of those ideas you have, and also with students of geodesign. And thank you very much for finding time, because I know like you're moving and you sound like it's really busy, regardless of anything that's happening in the world. So thank you for being very generous and very kind of thoughtful with when sharing your ideas on what you guys are doing, but also wider view on design.
Thank you for having us and for inviting us. It was a pleasure to have this conversation.
I feel that we've covered so many interesting topics with Simone, and actually got a really good insight into how him and Andrea ran Forma Fantasma as well. And I was just thinking about, you know, everything that like I took out from this conversation and what you might take out as well. And actually, it's a really great inspiration for when thinking about shaping your design or creative practice and how it can actually consist of various elements that feed into each other and provide various streams of work. And also, of course, apart from kind of the practice, when thinking about its output, I found it very interesting to hear Simone's thoughts on sustainability and how to work responsibly with materials, and how a design studio can help brands build better and more long-term sustainable design practices, and how really to spot those more kind of greenwashed requests and yes, and build something over a longer period of time. So I've left lots of links in show notes for you to find out more about geodesign, about the new website project, Aura Streams, Cambio. So I really hope that you'll kind of dive into it because there's so much more to learn. And that's all for today. And you know what to do. If you want to keep in touch with me between episodes, you can give me a follow on Instagram at Justina Green. And I'll see you here next week. Bye for now.